Let me in. Shiba, shiba. I want to be closer to you. Shiba, shiba. Open up your soul. Shiba, shiba. Let me find that part of you. The part that nobody ever knew.
Let me touch your. Hello and welcome to Let Me Touch Your Mind, the show where we try to get you to be something, do something, experience something, enjoy something, or if it's the first Monday of the month, understand something. You know how I love me some scientists, and Wonderfest always comes through with amazing scientists. I've got a special science envoy today to talk about a subject that I am very interested in, which is called geochronology. Here to talk about it is my science envoy du jour, Caroline Hassler. Welcome.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Thank you for being on the show. So tell me, Caroline, before we get into the geo part of it, when did you first get bitten by the science bug?
Yeah, I've been interested in science for as long as I can remember.
Mm-hmm.
Ever since I was a kid, I've always really loved going to science museums and natural history museums. So I think for a long time, the real question was which area of science I was going to end up in.
Okay.
When I was in high school, I was really into biology.
Okay.
So for a while, I thought I might become a biologist.
Uh-huh.
But then when I went to college, I ended up majoring in physics.
So okay.
Something totally different. I actually graduated with a physics degree. And it wasn't until my last year of college that I started to really think about what I wanted to do with the rest of my life, which
uh-huh.
is kind of a scary question to be asking yourself at
yes.
age 22.
Yes.
And I realized that although I really liked physics, I didn't really see myself being a physicist.
Okay.
Because a lot of physics research today is kind of abstract. You're either looking at really small things
mm-hmm.
or you're looking at stuff that's very far away, like in astrophysics. So I was looking for something that was a little more tangible, a
mm-hmm.
little more
tactile.
Yeah. And so I ended up pivoting into earth science for my PhD.
So how did you I have a few questions.
Yeah.
So before you were in high school and you were thinking about being a biologist, what did the little kid scientist want to be?
Well, I went through the usual phases of like wanting to be an astronaut, wanting to be a marine biologist.
Okay.
When I actually decided that I wanted to be an earth scientist, my mom said, oh, that makes sense because I remember when you were a kid and we used to go on vacation, you were always picking up pretty stones and interesting rocks. And so I guess she called it pretty early on.
I love that. So what was it? Like, how did you get to the earth sciences? Was there a particular class that you were taking that sort of awakened it? Or were you at a museum looking at rocks and went, that's for me? Or what was it?
I guess it was partly that where I did my undergrad, the earth science building was a really nice place to study.
Mm-hmm.
So it had a really nice open space that had a lot of light. So even though I was studying physics, I would sometimes go to the geology building just mm-hmm. to do my homework and study. And they had these really beautiful displays of rocks and minerals. So they had like these huge crystals and these really funky looking rocks.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think just being surrounded by that made me think, hey, this is maybe something that I could do.
And it certainly helps that it was in Switzerland.
Yeah.
You're just surrounded by these giant mountains.
Yeah. People always say this when I say I'm from Switzerland and now I'm a geologist.
Mm-hmm.
They're like, oh, that makes sense
it
because
makes
you grew up with all this cool geology. And I'm always like, huh, you know, growing up in Switzerland, I never really thought about it because I kind of took it for granted. Yeah, exactly.
Excellent. So now that you're no longer in Switzerland, can you appreciate it the way other people appreciate it who aren't from Switzerland?
Yeah, I think I do appreciate it a lot more. California is also really interesting in terms of geology, but it's very different, of course.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so let's talk about, so now you're doing geochronology and
yes.
explain that to our listening audience.
Yeah, I would love to. So When I'm at parties and people ask what I do, I usually just say that I'm a geologist. Because geochronology is kind of a big, difficult word. It comes from the Greek words for earth and time. So essentially it's the study of earth time, the timing of really important events in Earth's history.
Okay. So when I was a kid, I had this atlas, and it was an amazing atlas, and it had all of the periods, but I was so young that I didn't understand them. I was like six, and it was, you know, a substantial atlas, but it talked about all the periods, and I, you know, I actually have never given them much thought. So can you enlighten our listening audience about the ages of Earth?
Yeah. So I think this is a pretty common experience. A lot of people have maybe read a book about science, or they've been to a museum where they see some kind of like age printed on the wall next to a fossil or something. But most people can't really grasp those ages or don't really think about where they come from. So the Earth is 4.5 billion years old.
Okay.
That's when the Earth formed out of basically a big, like, swirling mass of gas and dust that was surrounding the sun at the time. So when Earth first formed, it was this big molten ball of lava, basically, that was kind of floating in space.
Okay.
And over time, it started to cool down. It formed a solid crust on its surface, which is good for us because that's where we live today. And then for a long time after that, nothing much happened because the Earth was still just a bunch of really hot rock that was kind of zooming through space.
Okay.
Life started to develop, we think, around 3.5 billion years ago. So at the time, there was water on Earth and there were oceans, and that's when we started to get these first little blobs of photosynthetic life in the Earth's oceans.
Okay, so the Earth is 4 billion years old.
Yes.
Life started 3.5 billion years ago.
Yeah, roughly.
So like there's like a 500 million years where nothing was really going on except the Earth was just sort of settling down into a planet.
Yeah, exactly.
And then life appears.
Yeah, life appears.
And nobody knows how or why or...
Yeah, that's still a really big mystery. So that's an area of research that I'm not myself involved in. There's a lot of biological research that goes on there. It does seem amazing to me that life could basically just form out of a bunch of stuff that was floating in the water. But it seems like that is essentially what happened. Yeah.
Okay. All right. So 3.5 billion years, Earth... Now there's life. Go on.
Yeah. So that life remained pretty simple for a really long time. So when you think about this early life, they really are just basically tiny, like, algae or little bacteria that are floating in the ocean.
Okay.
And that pretty much persisted until something called the Cambrian explosion, which was about 540 million years ago. So there's this interval of about 3 billion years.
Wow, okay.
Where not that much is happening in terms of evolving complex life.
Like most of the Earth's history, nothing's happening.
Yeah, or at least not. So there weren't like animals and plants the way we would recognize them today.
So are
until
these,
the Cambrian explosion.
So are these microscopic or do they have more size, these things that exist before the Cambrian?
That's a good question. So there may have been some bigger things around. I think jellyfish are pretty old from an evolutionary point of view, which kind of makes sense when you think of a jellyfish. It's also just kind of a blob of stuff that's floating in the ocean. So I think they might be older than that.
Okay.
But a lot of the stuff, you know, stuff that looks like insects or crabs or fish, things like that really didn't start to evolve until at least 500 million years ago.
So what is the Cambrian explosion?
Yeah, so that's, we call it an explosion because it's an event where it seems like really fast a lot of new species just started to appear. So it was an event where all of a sudden the oceans were just filled with this new life.
Okay, now when you say all of a sudden, what does that really mean?
Well, I guess, yeah. So when geologists say something happened really quickly, we don't mean like 5 seconds or something. We mean, you know,
millions
over a few millions of years.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. All right.
But on the time scale of the age of the Earth, I guess that's still pretty fast.
Yeah. Okay. So the Cambrian, there's this explosion of life. And what kind of life is it?
So a lot of really strange looking animals. You get some things that look a little bit like, you know, horseshoe crabs and stuff. You get some things that are sort of like mollusk-type animals, like shelly-type animals. You also get a lot of really freaky-looking, like squishy types of animals. A lot of these animals are no longer alive today, so okay. We only know of them from fossils.
Okay.
And they can be very strange-looking, like, you know, kind of jellyfish-type things, but with many legs that kind of walk around.
Uh-huh.
Animals with, like, they look like shells or mollusks, but they have, like, spines or feathery stuff on top.
Okay.
Yeah, a lot of really strange-looking stuff. If you go to a Natural History Museum, sometimes you'll see exhibits where they show these really freaky looking animals.
So you talk about these fossils that are like millions of years old, but how mm-hmm. how do scientists figure out how old something is and how do they know they're right?
Yeah, so this is where my branch of science comes in, geochronology.
Mm-hmm.
So the secret to figuring out the ages of these rocks and fossils is actually radioactivity.
Oh.
Which is kind of a scary word. I think when you say radioactivity to people, mm-hmm. a lot of people think of, like, you know, bombs or Chernobyl or all that scary mm-hmm. stuff. But a lot of people don't realize that low amounts of radioactivity are actually just a part of the natural world.
Okay.
It's all around us. So okay. there's a little bit of radioactive gas in the air that we breathe. There's radioactivity in rocks and in the water. Plants incorporate small amounts of radioactive carbon. And our bodies also have some radioactive carbon and potassium and other elements in them. So these low levels of radioactivity, they're not like dangerous, they're mm-hmm. just part of the natural world.
And at what point did scientists discover that there was radioactivity everywhere?
So radioactivity was discovered pretty recently. It was only around 1900 that people realized that radioactivity existed.
Okay.
And pretty quickly after that, geologists and scientists realized that you could use this to figure out the ages of things.
But how? Like, I mean, it's to yeah. me, that's a leap. Like,
yeah.
Oh, we found this weird energy. I bet it can tell time. I don't know how they made that.
Yeah, of course. So I'm happy to explain that. So when we talk about radioactivity, it really means that certain atoms are unstable.
Okay.
So if you have, for example, a uranium atom that is unstable, it decays and it transforms into another type of atom, in
okay.
this case, lead.
Okay.
So we, in science, call the original atom, the uranium atom, the parent,
mm-hmm.
and the thing that it transforms into, what you're left with at the end, is the daughter atom.
Okay.
And for geochronology, the important thing is that we know how long this transformation process takes. So there's a specific time that's associated with this transformation.
Mm-hmm.
And the way I kind of think about this is like an hourglass.
Okay.
So if you have an hourglass with sand in it
mm-hmm.
and you turn it over, initially you'll have a lot of sand at the top of the hourglass,
mm-hmm.
right? So that's like your parent atoms. That's okay. your uranium.
Okay.
And then over time, those little grains of sand will start falling through the hourglass into the bottom.
Mm-hmm.
And
that's the lead.
The transformation process. They're turning into lead.
Okay.
Right? So let's imagine that this hourglass, it's your hourglass. You use it a lot.
Mm-hmm.
You know it takes 1 minute to run, for all the sand to run down. So now if I were to show you a snapshot of that hourglass, if I take a picture and you see that the hourglass, the top is half full and the bottom is half full, you would be able to say, okay, half the time has passed,
mm-hmm.
so 30 seconds must have passed since
you
turned over the hourglass.
Okay.
And that's essentially what we're doing when we do geochronology. We're looking at how much of the parent we have,
mm-hmm.
how much of the daughter we have, and then because we know the time it takes for that transformation to happen,
mm-hmm.
we can figure out how much time has passed.
So then, how do you know that that transformation would take a million years or 100,000 years? Like, is it a mathematical thing? Is it something that's theorized? How do they know
that? It's something that's measured. So this is where physicists come in. You need to have someone who will actually take a bunch of uranium or whatever other radioactive substance you're interested in, and you kind of need to sit there and count how many decays are happening.
Okay, so See, I know I'm getting in the weeds here, but...
No, of course. Okay. Go ahead. This is great.
Okay, so you discover this thing in 1900, uranium or radiation.
Yeah.
But how do you know that after you've discovered it that it's taking that long? How do you know? Where do you get those numbers?
Yeah, so you would just take a chunk of your radioactive material and you can measure how much energy is coming off of that chunk of stuff.
Okay.
And you know that each of those little pulses of energy is a radioactive decay.
Mm-hmm.
So you can count, if you know you started out with like 100 atoms and you come back in an hour and you see that half of them have decayed,
mm-hmm.
you know that it will take about 2 hours for all of it to decay.
Okay.
So the decays that we deal with in geology take much longer, obviously, because they have to be useful on these long geological timescales.
Mm-hmm.
So those are measurements that are harder to make. But yeah, physicists can do that, and they have done it for a lot of these radioactive elements.
So does that mean there's a base element, like a fresh chunk of uranium, and they know that this fresh chunk of uranium is losing it at this rate, and then they kind of use that as their gauge for what's going on in other things?
Well, once you have a really precise measurement of how long that decay takes,
mm-hmm.
that number doesn't change. Like, that's the same for any uranium atom. Any uranium atom will decay at that same rate.
Okay.
So once you have that measurement, anyone can use that and use that to back out the ages of rocks and fossils.
And so do rocks and fossils have a different decay rate from a uranium fossil? Or is it the same?
Well, the uranium is in the rocks. So like I said, there's a little bit of radioactive stuff that's just present in the natural world.
Mm-hmm.
So if I pick up a rock somewhere, there might be some trace amounts of uranium in that rock.
Mm.
And so that is what I can measure.
Okay.
So when we go out and we pick up rocks and fossils, we are looking for rocks or fossils that specifically have radioactive elements that we can measure.
Okay. And so things that are fossilized by the very fact that they are rocks,
yeah.
have somehow trapped that radioactivity inside of it.
Yeah. They can do that. What geochronologists will usually do is we will look for volcanic rocks because those tend to have radioactive elements that are really good for us to measure. And the good thing about volcanic eruptions in particular is that we know that they happened really quickly.
Mm-hmm.
So if you find a fossil and then you find a volcanic rock right above it, you can take that volcanic rock and date it, and then you know you have an age limit for that fossil. If you try to date the fossil itself, that's a little more difficult because it takes a while for that fossilization to happen.
Mm-hmm.
So if you date a fossil, you're not dating when that animal lived or died. You're dating when it turned into a rock.
Okay. Yeah. And how long does it take for something to turn into a fossil?
It can take a while. I don't actually know. I've never made a fossil.
Oh. All right. So you have these volcanic eruptions. Where are some of the places that you get your volcanic rock from so that you can do your geochronology?
Yeah. So one of the projects that I've been working on in my PhD is in eastern Montana.
Mm-hmm.
So that's an area where there are a lot of really interesting fossils because it records the Cretaceous Paleogene mass extinction, which is another really big word. But basically, it's the dinosaur extinction.
Okay.
So this is what happened about 66 million years ago when a really big asteroid hit the Earth and all the dinosaurs and most large land animals were just wiped out.
And was that pretty instantaneous because of the magnitude of the strike? Or?
Yeah, so the extinction would have been pretty fast. There would have been a bunch of things that happened after this big asteroid impact. So initially, there would have been a huge amount of heat in the atmosphere.
Mm.
So it's thought that trees and plants would just spontaneously catch fire because it was so hot in the aftermath of the impact. And that obviously would have had a big effect on a lot of plants and animals. A lot of them would have died just then. If they did manage to survive that, for example, if they were able to find some nice, you know, cool pond to hide in, or if they were able to bury themselves underground, they then had to face what we call the impact winter. So when the asteroid struck the ground, it vaporized a lot of stuff that was in the rock. And it especially vaporized a lot of sulfur. So we know where the asteroid struck. It's in Mexico. It's called Chicxulub. And the ocean rocks that are around there, they contain a lot of sulfur. So that would have been thrown up into the atmosphere. And sulfur in the atmosphere forms these little blobby things called aerosols, which block out sunlight. So what would have happened is basically an extended, really cold, really dark period on Earth when plants struggled to photosynthesize, animals struggled to find food, and that could have lasted a while as well. So that it's thought that over 70% of species on Earth did not survive this event because it was just so devastating for life on Earth.
That's crazy. So how did they know, or how did they figure out that the asteroid hit in this particular place other than the, like what took them there for them to go, oh, let's measure this?
Yeah, well, initially they did not know, actually. So the first sign that there might have been this really big asteroid impact did not come from finding the actual crater. It came just from looking at rocks from this time period and noticing that there was a layer of this pretty rare metal called iridium in the rocks, in basically the exact layer where the mass extinction happened. And that was kind of weird because iridium is really rare on Earth. Most of the iridium in the Earth is down in Earth's core, so not on the surface. But it's known that iridium is really common in meteorites, in like metallic meteorites that hit Earth. And so that seemed to be a sign that probably a really big meteorite must have struck Earth and left this thin little crust of iridium. So that's when the hypothesis came up that an asteroid could have been responsible for the mass extinction. But people didn't know about the crater yet. So people started looking for it, and a bunch of different craters were proposed. The one in Mexico, we know about it with different methods. So you can actually use gravitational or seismic measurements to see what's inside the seafloor, what's underneath. And so we know that there's a big circular crater about 120 miles big that's like buried underneath the sediments on the seafloor there.
Where the impact was?
Yeah, that's where the impact was.
Now, I heard that it maybe came in at an angle and sort of skidded off, or did it just hit and explode?
Yeah, well, a lot of the initial impactor material would have been vaporized as well. So we don't find like really big chunks of the meteorite. The energy of the impact would have been so great that basically a lot of the rock was just like vaporized and sprayed up into the atmosphere. There is a whole branch of science that basically just looks at impacts. And yeah, people do discuss the angles at which meteorites hit and stuff like that. For me, the interesting thing is the effect that the impact had on life on Earth. One of my professors used to say that everything that was bigger than a golden retriever died during this mass extinction.
Lucky golden retrievers.
Yeah. Well, they weren't around yet, but yeah.
So what kept the water from completely just evaporating and leaving the Earth's atmosphere?
Yeah, well, quite a bit of water would have been vaporized, but the oceans are pretty big. And during the phase when it was very cold on Earth, there would not have been a lot of like evaporation from the oceans.
So you have this huge event. And what was that event called again?
It's called the Cretaceous-Paleogene mass extinction. So this is because it is the boundary between two geological eras called the Cretaceous. The Cretaceous lasted from about 150 million years ago to 66 million years ago when mm-hmm. that impact happened. Mm-hmm. And then the Paleogene came after that.
And what does Cretaceous mean and what does Paleogene?
Paleogene. So Cretaceous means chalky. Okay. And it's because there are like chalk rocks, chalk deposits from that time. Paleo means old. So there are quite a few geological eras that are just called paleo something, meaning this is a bunch of old rock.
Yeah. Okay, okay. In case you haven't figured out, my science background was abysmal, so I'm loving everything you're telling me because it's opening up a world of knowledge.
So. Yeah, I love that. I'm so glad.
So you have this period, everything bigger than a golden retriever is dead. Mm-hmm. What is going on from that point forward?
Yeah, so that's the fascinating thing. When I was in Montana last summer, I was part of a pretty big team of geologists and paleontologists mm-hmm. who were all out there trying to figure out essentially what happened in the aftermath mm-hmm. of this mass extinction. And this is really important actually for us as humans, as mammals, because before the extinction, the Earth was basically dominated by dinosaurs.
Okay.
But we had these, you know, giant T-Rex and all these other dinosaurs that were just running around. Mammals did exist at that time, but they were really small. Mm-hmm. And they were basically hiding in the trees or hiding in burrows underground.
So they wouldn't get eaten by the big mammals.
Yeah, exactly. So they wouldn't get eaten by the big dinosaurs. Mm-hmm. And it was only when the dinosaurs went extinct that these small, scared, furry little mammals were able to come out of their holes and start to really evolve. So as cataclysmic as that extinction was, without it, we wouldn't be here today.
Okay. And when you talk about small, are we talking like mice and gerbils, or are we talking small relative to a dinosaur? Like are they human-sized?
They would not have been human-sized. They would have been smaller than that. So yeah, basically, like you were saying, think of mice, think of like squirrel-sized organisms.
Okay.
Yeah.
And so that's the Paleogene?
The Paleogene, yeah.
Paleogene.
So in the Paleogene, that's when we really start to see the rise of mammals because they weren't under the thumb of the dinosaurs anymore.
So you and a bunch of people are in Montana, and what are you looking for? Are you looking at rocks? Like, what is it you hope to find in Montana that you may have found?
Yeah, so the paleontologists are looking for mammal fossils.
Okay.
And I did some of that too. Basically, what you do is you're looking for any fragment of a mammal bone, mostly teeth, because the teeth tend to be well preserved. But because these animals are so small, the teeth are really tiny. So the way you find them is you just get on the ground, you lie on your stomach, and you just crawl.
Wow.
And you do that for hours at a time, yeah.
Okay.
So that's what you do, and it can be tough. You're out there under the hot sun in the desert, crawling on your stomach all day. But the feeling when you find a mammal tooth is just so exhilarating.
Have you found a mammal
tooth? Yeah, I found a bunch of mammal teeth.
A bunch?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I found some really good ones. So they're now with the paleontologists up at UW.
So when you say really good ones, like what are they? Like what animals have you found?
So I did ask the paleontologists, and they have their own terminology. So they would tell me, oh, this is probably an ungulate, which I'm not totally sure what that is, but it looked cool.
Okay. So how do you distinguish between a stone or pebble and a tooth that is fossilized?
That's a really good question. Yeah, I had that question too at first when I first went out there.
Okay.
I was crawling and I was picking up random tiny pebbles and I was like, is this a tooth? Is this a tooth? But honestly, when you do see one, you'll know.
Really?
Yeah. When you do see one, it does look different. So, well, I mean, we all have teeth, so we kind of mm-hmm. know what they look like. Mm-hmm. But yeah, if it's a tooth that's somewhat well preserved, you'll see like a little pointy root at the bottom and you'll see like the knobbly bits on the top. So the teeth are, they look sufficiently toothy.
And how do you know that they're not just something that died recent, like in the last 100 years versus million years?
So the fossilized ones are usually black.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
So when you're in Montana, you're looking for you see a black stone, and you're like, that could be a tooth. No, this isn't it. That could be a tooth. No.
Yep.
This is a tooth.
Yeah, that's what you're doing.
Okay.
Yeah.
And then when you find a tooth, do you sort of proclaim it and everyone gathers around, or do you just keep going?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. You proclaim it, yeah.
Oh, okay.
And then everyone gets really happy, and then everyone gets back on their stomach and keeps crawling.
So in the group that you were with, was everyone able to find a tooth?
Most people did, yeah. If you're at a site where there are a lot of teeth, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It's kind of surprising, because if I hadn't been with the paleontologist, I would have just walked right over all these teeth, but... Yeah, you get a bunch of people together crawling on the ground and you find stuff.
So what's the geography like in Montana?
It's what's
I think
called,
of it flat.
Yeah, it's not flat. So in this part of eastern Montana, it's what's called a Badlands landscape.
Mm-hmm.
So there are these hills, kind of like sandy looking hills with very little vegetation.
Okay.
And they can be quite tall. They can be quite steep.
Mm-hmm.
So... They look quite striking, actually, if you look up a picture of them. Because there's so little vegetation, you can really see stripes of different colors, of different types of rock on the hillsides.
Okay.
So you might see black coal layers, or you'll see kind of reddish sandstone layers,
uh-huh.
or more white layers. So it can be quite beautiful.
Is that exciting to go someplace and go, I recognize all of these eras?
Yeah, it kind of is exciting. Yeah, you get to know the geology and the geography pretty well if you're just scrambling around the hills for a few weeks.
Okay, okay. So you've collected these teeth, and then what happens?
Yeah, so then as a geochronologist, as someone who was on the geology side, one of our jobs was to find rocks that we can date. So find rocks that have these datable materials, this radioactive stuff in them.
In addition to the teeth.
Yeah,
okay.
Because they want to know how old the teeth are, right? So
mm-hmm.
finding the teeth is great, but what the paleontologists really want to know is how old are these teeth? How quickly did mammals start to evolve after the dinosaur extinction? So we're trying to reconstruct that timeline, and for that we need geochronology.
Okay.
So the geologists among us would then go out into the hills and try to find, actually we would look at these coal layers. So we would go to these thick black layers in the hills
mm-hmm.
and we would look for volcanic ash. So when a volcano erupts, it will spread out a bunch of volcanic rock and it will also erupt a bunch of fine ash that kind of floats around in the air and then settles down.
Mm-hmm.
And those volcanic ashes have minerals that we can date
okay.
with geochronology. So we would dig around in these coal layers looking for ashes, and when we found a nice-looking ash, we would collect a bag of it, ship it home, and then analyze it.
Okay. I have several questions.
Yeah.
I'm trying to make sure I remember them all. I'm going to start with the one that I can remember. So the background of this is like when Vesuvius erupted, there are these people, you know, that their form was forever immortalized.
Like, yeah.
So if you found that, you knew what a human looked like.
Yeah.
Okay. So when people would find old whale bones, they didn't know what whales looked like. And I've seen the pictures of what they thought whales looked like. They
yeah.
simply on the skeletons, and whales look nothing like what they thought they looked like. So with those two extremes, do you have fossil records or volcanic things that have captured an animal in its full form, or is it just their skeletal remains?
Ooh, that's a good question. It's mostly just skeletal remains.
Okay.
Yeah. So if you walk around in this part of Montana, you can find, there are a lot of triceratops out there,
mm-hmm.
so you can find triceratops bones. As far as I know, there's no case where people have found like the whole form, like
mm-hmm.
you said, of a dinosaur preserved.
Because I think about like the T-Rex with their little
thalidomide
arms.
Yeah.
And then I think, well, we have kangaroos, and kangaroos are sort of, you know, they're kind of the like mini T-Rexes. They've got those little flippy arms. And I think, what if we've got it wrong and they actually just look like giant kangaroos?
I think, I can't remember what kind of dinosaur this is, but I think there was a kind of dinosaur where when people found it, they thought it might have hopped initially. like a kangaroo.
Uh-huh.
And then eventually they decided that dinosaurs were probably too heavy and clumsy to be able to do that.
Oh, I disagree. All right. So you have these fossils. Are there places in the world where the volcanic output is so pronounced that you can go further back in time than in other places with volcanic output?
Yeah. So in general, this is a difficult thing about doing geochronology or geology, right? You need to have the rocks that are preserved.
Mm-hmm.
So this gets especially difficult when you want to go really far back in time into mm-hmm. Earth's early history. A lot of those rocks just aren't around anymore.
Okay.
So the oldest little crystals that we have are about 4 billion years old, but it's really difficult to find, you know, a complete rock that's a complete record of really far back in Earth's history. Depending on where you are, though, you can find rocks that are really, really old
mm-hmm.
and that go really far back. And there have been volcanoes on Earth pretty much since the beginning of Earth's history.
Sure. So are there places in the world that yield more information about the Earth's history than other places? Like,
yeah.
You go, oh, this is a hotbed of historic information.
Well, for example, the area that I was in last summer, so like eastern Montana and the mm-hmm. Dakotas, that's a great area if you want to study what happened at the dinosaur extinction,
mm-hmm.
because it's one of the few places on Earth where we have a record of what happened on land. So we have a lot of other rocks that were at the bottom of the ocean
mm-hmm.
at that time,
mm-hmm.
and so you can use those rocks to trace what was going on in the oceans, but obviously that doesn't tell you about the death of the dinosaurs or the evolution of mammals.
Okay.
So that area in the continental U.S., like I said, Montana, the Dakotas, that's really one of the best places in the world for that particular thing if you want to
wow.
study the dinosaur extinction.
Okay.
And then other areas of the world are good for different stuff. Obviously,
mm-hmm.
if you're interested in early human evolution, which is more recent,
mm-hmm.
there are places in, for example, South Africa, or Eastern Africa, that are just a really rich bed of fossils
okay.
from that time.
So in your work in geochronology, what is something that you learned about that just blew your mind?
I think what blows my mind again and again is just how fascinating and how rich Earth's history is.
Mm-hmm.
What really blew my mind was learning that there have been a lot of mass extinctions in Earth's history.
Oh, really?
Yeah, a lot of them. So most kids learn about the dinosaur extinction,
yes.
right, which is kind of the popular one.
Mm-hmm.
But actually in the last 500 million years, so since this Cambrian explosion,
mm-hmm.
there have been 5 really big mass extinctions.
Do tell.
So the first one was the End Ordovician extinction, which was about, I think, 450 million years ago.
Okay.
And that's when a lot of these, like, weird creatures that first evolved during the Cambrian explosion were just wiped out.
Okay.
Then there was another one not too long after that, the Devonian extinction, where, as far as we know, the oceans just became really low in oxygen.
Oh.
And so a lot of creatures just could not survive that.
Okay.
Then there was about 250 million years ago, there was the worst mass extinction that we know of, the Permian-Triassic mass extinction. And it's thought that about 90%, up to 90% of species on Earth just died and went extinct.
Why?
People debate this a lot. So what we do know is that there was a huge amount of volcanic activity going on in what is now Siberia.
Okay.
So we find these massive outpourings of lava, which are called the Siberian Traps. And it's thought that that huge amount of volcanisms could have just destroyed Earth's climate.
Mm.
So when we have a big volcanic eruption today, there are sometimes effects on the environment,
mm-hmm.
right? Like if there's a really big eruption, flights might be delayed because of ash in the air, right? Yeah. The sky might change color locally, kind of like when there are wildfires in California, you might get a creepy red sky or something. So we know that even one big volcanic eruption can have a big impact on Earth's climate.
Mm-hmm.
Usually it doesn't last that long. But if you have these...
Well, that long is relative.
Yeah, of course. It's always relative.
Okay.
So if we have just one volcanic eruption, you know, within a few weeks, the flight schedules will be back up and running.
Sure.
And the sky will be a normal color. But in Siberia, these eruptions would have lasted a few million years. If you have massive volcanic eruptions and lava being produced over millions of years, then obviously that could have a really severe effect on Earth's climate.
Wow.
So that is one of the main suspects for this mass extinction, is that the climate change due to the CO2, sulfur, a lot of other gases that would have been released, that would just have made it really difficult for plants and animals to survive.
Wow. So now this is going to be a sticky question for you. So how do you respond to people who say the Earth is only 5,000 years old?
Yeah, that is a difficult question. So I guess the answer is I usually don't. I try not to.
Okay.
If people ask that question or say that with the intention to learn something, I'm happy to engage.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, if people have grown up with certain beliefs and that's a really integral part of their belief system and their life, then I'm not going to be able to change their mind just by talking about radioactive decay. So, yeah.
Okay. All right. So you talked about all of this volcanic activity. Are there any times when there's volcanic activity in the world that reveals new fossils, or is it just, or is it covering up the fossils that are already there?
Okay. That's an interesting question. I guess something that's more likely to reveal fossils is tectonic activity or erosion.
Mm-hmm.
So part of the reason that we find a lot of fossils in this very dry landscape in Montana is that there's a lot of erosion there, so the fossils, you can literally just see them sticking out of the hills sometimes.
Oh.
So you might be walking up a hill and you just see like a dinosaur bone sticking out. And that's because you have very little vegetation, so there's no bushes or shrubs hiding the stuff. And you also have these steep hillsides where a lot of stuff is like falling out.
Wow.
So
just
that's
sticking out of the rocks.
Yeah. Yeah,
that's
absolutely
crazy. Is it possible that Montana used to be filled with water and then in one day it just disappeared and that's why you're able to see all that stuff?
So there did used to be a sea called the Western Interior Seaway in what is now like the northern, like midwestern to western part of the United States.
Okay.
So you do find from farther back than the dinosaur extinction, you find things like ammonites and shells and marine animals that used to live there. Yeah, we know that there was a sea there. So when you imagine like the dinosaurs walking around in Montana, they weren't walking around in the dry landscape that's there today. They would have been walking around on like a swampy river plain with lots of plants and like rivers running through it down to the sea.
Okay. So as a geochronologist, what's your favorite thing to do when you're at work? I mean, you already talked about crawling on your belly looking for teeth, but you know, that can't sustain you forever. So what's one of the things that you get, you're like, oh, I'm so excited I get to do this today, or I get to study this today, or...
Yeah, well, the field work is probably the most amazing part, like being out there collecting the rocks, really getting to interact with the paleontologists as well and learning about their side of it. So that is definitely my favorite part. There are lots of things that are enjoyable in different ways. So when I'm having a bad day, something that's kind of fun is just crushing up my rocks.
Okay.
When we collect them, they're like these big big chunks of rock.
Uh-huh.
And at some point, you have to smash them down into little pieces.
Okay.
So I just do that with like a sledgehammer, which can be kind of fun.
Oh, that, yeah. You had me at sledgehammer. Oh, wow. That's great.
Yeah.
So when you go to different museums and stuff, you know how they have the big bins with all of the polished rocks?
Yeah.
Are you ever tempted or you're like, I can make my own?
Yeah, well, I do have a lot of cool rocks. Most of the geologists that I know, their offices will have like a shelf mm-hmm. or a little collection of mm-hmm. cool rocks.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, I do have some. When I came back from Montana, I brought home some rocks, but also some fossils, like some bits of Triceratops bone and stuff that I found.
And you get to keep those?
Some of them, yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. Like some of them, for example, there are also these like fossilized fish teeth that the paleontologists are less interested in.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
And so at some point they were just like, yeah, if you find a fish tooth or a fish scale, it's like whatever.
Man, if I were a kid and I went to your house, I would just be in heaven. Do you ever take your stuff around to show kids at school all of this stuff? Because that just sounds like a
Well, I took them to the office and I like handed them out to my friends. So a lot of my friends actually also now have bits of Triceratops or bits
wow.
of prehistoric fish or like turtle bones from the Cretaceous.
See, I never think of these historic fossils, like how old are they? I never think of them as something you can just have.
Yeah. If you're a paleontologist or a geologist, you can, yeah.
That's crazy. What is your favorite fossil or rock that you have? And I'm sure it probably changes from, you know, week to week.
Yeah. I am especially fond of my little bit of Triceratops bone.
Mm-hmm.
Just because I think that's really cool. I love Triceratops. They're my favorite dinosaur. So getting to see their fossils out in the wild and getting to touch them was just really amazing.
So what is it about the Triceratops that attracts you? I had godchildren that were like obsessed with dinosaurs and
yeah.
they knew every single one of them. So what was it about the Triceratops?
I guess on a shallow level, I just think they look really cool.
Oh, okay.
They have this big, so Triceratops are the ones that have this big like frill on the back of their head.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Almost like a shield that comes up and
uh-huh.
then they have like the three horns. So I just think they look awesome. They look kind of scary with the horns, but they were probably just herd animals, kind of like cows, actually. So they would just have, you know, roamed around grazing together.
So they were like herbivores?
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah,
nice.
Yeah, they were. So I think that's kind of nice.
Okay, okay. So when you do your geochronology, who are you working with to do all of this stuff? Because you say you're UC Berkeley. Is there a lab or?
Yeah. So there is a lab. I work at the Berkeley Geochronology Center,
mm-hmm.
which is a whole little institution that basically just does geochronology. And all the researchers there are working on like different radioactive elements. So we use different machines to do our measurements and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But we're all basically working on different problems related to geochronology.
Okay. What are some of the other problems that you haven't mentioned about geochronology?
Yeah, well, one of the really big ones that I don't work on in particular, but my advisor works on a lot, is human evolution, human
mm-hmm.
origins.
Mm-hmm.
So there are a lot of open questions relating to how exactly humans evolved and how exactly they dispersed across the world.
Mm-hmm.
So that's one of the really big questions. People who are doing archaeological digs in Africa are always finding new fossils that they need to figure out. Like, where does this fit into the human evolutionary tree? How old is this fossil? How did these people live? What did they do? Where did they go? So all of these questions are really interesting and important to people.
And how do you carbon date something that is, because when I think of you find this skull, let's say,
mm-hmm.
and there's no other skull like it, so you can't be crushing it with a sledgehammer.
Yeah.
So do you date the stuff that it was found in? Do you take a tiny sample? Like, how do you
yes.
keep it intact?
So what you would most likely do is what I said before, where you're not dating the actual fossil. You're looking for these layers of volcanic stuff, like
mm-hmm.
ash
mm-hmm.
or a volcanic rock, above or below where the fossil was found.
Okay.
And if you can date those, you can put limits on the age. So if I find a volcanic rock right above the fossil and it's a million years old, mm-hmm. and then I find another rock below the fossil and it's like 1.1 million years old, then I know that the fossil has to be between those two ages.
Okay. And then are there times when the fossil is sort of without context, like you find it, but there was nothing above or below to give you any reference?
Yeah, that can happen. It's unfortunate when that does happen. Yeah, sometimes the fossils are in really bad condition. It also happens, so, you know, Earth's history is pretty complicated and there's a lot going on. So sometimes fossils just get transported by a river. They might end up really far from where they were deposited. Mm-hmm. And so you have to be really careful when you're a geologist and when you're in these settings, you have to look for that kind of stuff and you have to try to evaluate if this fossil is where it belongs and if you can really use these rocks to reliably date it. And sometimes you can't.
Okay. Now I have like just a personal question for you. So you've gone into the earth sciences, you've got all of these beautiful rocks and everything. When you go home, like, how do you explain it to your family? Do they have the same level of interest? Do they have shelves of rocks?
They think it's interesting. So it's not my parents' background, for example. My dad is a medical doctor and my mom studied finance and business. So, like, not the same kind of background at all. But they do think it's interesting. My mom, this is kind of sweet, she's read some books about like geology and volcanoes and stuff and Earth history to try to understand what I'm doing. Mm-hmm. And yeah, it is interesting to tell them about it. I love talking about my science and my research, so I'm always happy to do that.
Okay, and do you ever have kids ask you what you do?
Yeah, sometimes. Like I said, I usually say I'm a geologist and then I talk about dinosaurs, which is pretty popular.
Yep. You bring up the dinosaur, you've got a built-in audience.
Yeah, crowd pleaser every time.
And do you have a particular rock that you love? Like you know, like amber or azurite or something, you know, something that you, whenever you see it, you're like, yep, there it is.
That's a really good question. I think it changes from time to time, just depending on whatever rock I've seen recently or interacted with recently. So when I'm in the mountains, I love granite. Like in the Sierra Nevada, in the Alps, there's granite. That's really beautiful. Mm-hmm. Also very popular for countertops. So you get to see a lot of it if you're in a fancy kitchen. Mm-hmm. Then a couple of years ago, I had the chance to go to the East Coast and I was able to collect some garnet. Like they're like these little red stones. I think it's someone's birthstone. And
garnet.
Okay. Yeah, they're kind of amazing because they're shaped like little like soccer balls.
Oh,
yeah, which is really cool.
Okay.
So I was able to just collect some of those near this river, and that was so exciting.
So do you have rocks from all over the world?
I do. If I'm traveling somewhere and I find a cool rock, I will pick it up. Yeah.
Okay.
And if I have a friend who's traveling somewhere where there are cool rocks, mm-hmm. I will ask them to pick one up for me.
Excellent. So have you been to the Petrified Forest? Because you can't take it from the Petrified Forest.
No,
but
I know.
If you're outside, it's just everywhere.
Yeah, I have seen a lot of petrified wood. It's awesome. It's beautiful. I love it.
It's crazy because you're like, that's surely wood. That's surely wood. That can't. And It's
a rock.
It's wild.
I know.
It's
I don't have any petrified wood because, like you said, you're not supposed to collect it. But yeah, I do. I love seeing it.
Yeah. But again, when you're outside, it's just on the street.
Yeah, so I know. Amazing.
So for listeners who maybe are interested in geology and geochronology, but maybe not don't have a deep scientific understanding, what would you suggest as an entry level like book or website that they could look at to just, you know, pique their interests?
That's a good question. You know, I would say I think geology is one of those things that is best like experienced in person.
Mm-hmm.
So I would say if you're really interested in learning more about it, just like go outside, go for a walk somewhere in the Berkeley Hills or even in San Francisco. There's a website, I think it might even be an app called Streetcar to Subduction, I think.
Okay.
Where they're all like accessible by public transport, but you can go to different sites around the city and around the bay that will teach you something interesting about like the local geology.
I love it. And you think it's called
Streetcar to Subduction?
I love that.
I think that's what it's called, yeah.
I love that. Well, Caroline Hassler, it has been a pleasure having you on the show today.
Yeah, it's been a pleasure for me, too. Thank you so much for having me.
You're welcome. Hey, people. Geology, chronology. Put them together like a Reese's peanut butter cup. You got geochronology, and it's awesome. You're listening to 89.5 FM KPOO San Francisco. Yes, I'm about to engage in a really bad pun before I leave because she's all about the Stones. So this is the Supremes and Stoned Love.
Believe, stone.